Thank you for tuning in to the Israel Podcast, Episode 6, The Dreyfus Affair, Part 2, Degradation. Last time, we went over the rags-to-riches story of the Dreyfus family from Alsace, and how Captain Alfred Dreyfus came to inherit a huge fortune, marry into a larger fortune, and climb up the ranks in the French military. He was one of three brothers that all joined the French army following the German occupation of their hometown in Alsace. And while his brothers focused on careers in industry, he chose to pursue a career in the military. He became a captain and a stagiaire on the French high command, the état-major, and even got high praise from the commander of the French army himself. Things seemed to be going quite well for Captain Dreyfus, but the usual dark clouds of anti-Semitism were gathering. And when we last left off, Alfred's brother, Mathieu, received an urgent telegram in his house in German-occupied Mulhouse and immediately set off to Paris the very same day. So we continue this story. On the night between October 31st and November 1st, 1894, Mathieu Dreyfus, Alfred's older brother, was heading to Paris. During the all-night journey from Mulhouse, Mathieu was certainly thinking that something grave has happened to Alfred. It is highly unlikely, however, that he imagined the possibility of high treason. Alfred had been arrested only 2 weeks before and held under strictest secrecy. His wife, Lucy, had not been allowed to see her husband or write to him. And only in the last few hours before she telegrammed Mathieu, she finally got permission from army officials to contact the family. When Mathieu was arriving in Paris, newspaper vendors were already selling papers with accounts of an espionage trial in the making. After the first reports on the high treason of a French officer were published, journalists started to investigate further. On October 31st, Le Soir published the essential detail, Dreyfus's name. A day later, Drumont's La Libre Parole added the critical adjective to its November 1st edition, arrest of a Jewish officer. Mathieu rejoined Lucy and learned that she had not seen Alfred since Monday morning, October 15th. The previous Saturday, the captain had received orders by special messenger to appear at the état-major for an inspection of staff officers. Alfred found it strange that a general inspection, usually conducted in the afternoon, had been rescheduled for Monday morning. And even more peculiar, why the note insisted that he dress in civilian clothes. It was also very strange that the messenger had returned later to demand a written receipt confirming acknowledgement of the order. On that Monday, Alfred did not return to his apartment for lunch. Instead, two men from the état-major showed up at Lucy's doorstep. Commandant Mercier du Parti de Clam and Armand Cochefort, a police functionary assigned to the Army's Criminal Investigations Department. As Lucy answered the door, Dupatie's first words were, "I am, Madame, on a sad mission." "My husband is dead," cried out Lucy. "No, worse than that," continued Dupatie. "No, Madame, he is in prison." The two men refused to tell her the charges brought against her husband or the name of the prison in which he was held. They went on and searched the apartment, noted the amount of cash in drawers and in Lucy's purse, and then left with a threat. Knowing of Alfred's and Lucy's family members in Mulhouse, Dupatie insisted that she tell no one of her husband's arrest. "One word, a single word uttered by you," he warned, "and he will be ruined. The only way to save him is through silence. Lucy, only 24 years old, alone at home with two children, and sharing her husband's respect for the military, was convinced that the Etat Major would quickly realize its error. She therefore followed Dupaty's order, and the next day she even gathered letters and correspondence overlooked by Dupaty and delivered them to the General Staff Headquarters. She hoped that her willingness to cooperate would be rewarded with news of Alfred. It was not. Still offering no details of the charges brought against her husband, Dupaty told Lucy, "It is my absolute conviction that your husband is guilty." Dupaty hoped to break her resolve and extract a confession. But with every interview, she became more determined. "I tried to show him his error," she later said. "I told him about my husband's character, about his frankness, integrity, and loyalty, and about his sense of duty and love for the fatherland. He was innocent," she insisted, "and the general staff had made a grave error." But it did no good. The strength of Lucy's character only increased Dupaty's suspicions. A young woman with a traitorous husband should be much less composed. Finally, in late October, aware that newspapers planned to break the story, Dupaty allowed Lucy Dreyfus to contact her family. By the morning of November 1st, as she waited with Rachel on the platform at the station, all she knew was that Alfred had been accused of transmitting military secrets to a foreign power, and that the Council of Ministers was considering an indictment. With Mathieu's arrival in Paris, the family's fight for Alfred's release has finally begun. Telegrams and letters went out from Paris through the first week of November, calling family members from Toulouse and from across France. Alfred's sisters, brothers, and in-laws gathered each day at the Parisian apartment. Every time Alfred's young children entered the room, they were told simply that their father had left on an army assignment. Dupaty returned to the apartment, the apartment he had searched so many times over recent days. To shield Lucy from the strange commandant's outbursts, Mathieu took the man into a separate room and asked for the charges brought against his brother. "I can tell you nothing," said Dupaty, "except that he is guilty." "You are convinced of his guilt," said Mathieu. "I am not." Then Mathieu proposed the ultimate test. "Let me see my brother alone, under any conditions you wish. Place witnesses in an adjoining room or behind doors. I swear on my honor that I will ask him if he committed a crime, if he is guilty or not. And if he confesses, I shall hand him the gun with which he will commit suicide." Dupaty was not impressed and turned Mathieu down. On November 9th, La Libre Parole published a statement by General Bonfons, the officer who had tried to block Dreyfus's promotion to the Etat Major. "You know, we buy our information on foreign armies, Italian Jews, German Jews, Romanian Jews. Sell us all we need. And you want to place Jews on our general staff? Why would a French Jew behave any differently than the others?" Dreyfus entered the army with a premeditated plan of committing treason against it, reported La Libre Parole on November 14th. "As a Jew and as a German, he detests the French. German by taste and education, Jew by race, he does their work and nothing else." Other papers insisted of an international Jewish conspiracy to ruin the French people and to monopolize the land of France. Unfortunately, I'm quite sure the rhetoric will sound familiar to many of you listeners out there. Only one sympathetic journalist, Emile Bergerat, agreed that the captain had, and I quote, the right to be innocent. Journalists simply ignored three generations of the family's history and concentrated instead on the Dreyfus's supposed allegiance to the Germans. How quickly can the climate change? The Dreyfus apartment became the besieged headquarters of a family resolved to securing Alfred's release. They were willing to devote a fortune to do so, and luckily for Alfred, they had a considerable one. The family began the search for a lawyer and contacted one Maître Edgar Demange. Demange, a fervent Catholic and profound admirer of the army, was also a true professional. He listened to Mathieu's request and agreed to take the case only if certain conditions were met. I will be your brother's first judge, he told Mathieu. If I find in his dossier any charge whatsoever which leads me to doubt his innocence, I will refuse to defend him. This proposition is extremely serious, he added. The day the public learns that I have turned down your brother's case, it will conclude that he is guilty, and he will be irredeemably lost. Mathieu agreed to the conditions without hesitation. And finally, on December 3rd, Demange received permission to review the prisoner's file. Same night, he called Lucie and Mathieu to his office and with profound emotion said, if Captain Dreyfus were not Jewish, he would not be in Cherche Midi prison. He is accused of treason based on a single, unsigned, and undated document that had been transmitted to a foreign power. The handwriting had a certain resemblance to Alfred's, but two or three experts had insisted that Dreyfus was not the author. That was it. There were no other charges and no other evidence. It is an abomination, said Demange. Never have I seen such a dossier. If there is justice, your brother will be acquitted. On the following day, 6 weeks after Alfred Dreyfus had lost all contact with his family, Demange met the prisoner at Cherche Midi and learned the details of his arrest and interrogation. Shortly after 8 a.m. on Monday, October 15th, in civilian dress, as ordered, Lieutenant Georges Picard, who had been one of his instructors at the École de Guerre, directed him to the office of the chief of staff he had so impressed only a few months before. Dreyfus was surprised that other officers, normally called to general inspection, were not present, nor was the chief of staff. Instead, he found Commandant Dupaty and three strangers in civilian clothes. Displaying a black silk glove on his right hand, Dupaty announced that he had injured his finger and asked the captain to take dictation while they waited for the general to arrive. Seated at a small desk with Dupaty at his side, Dreyfus began writing a note that dealt with sensitive military matters. Dreyfus hesitated. He was confused by the entire situation and surprised that an officer would so readily share information concerning weaponry and army maneuvers, especially in the presence of civilians. What's the matter? Interrupted Dupaty. You're trembling. Not at all, Dreyfus responded, taken aback by the hostile tone. He resumed writing, but Dupaty stopped him again. Pay attention, he shouted. This is serious. Dreyfus made an effort to concentrate. Then Dupaty placed his hand on the captain's shoulder and announced in a loud voice, "I arrest you in the name of the law. You are accused of the crime of high treason." As the commandant read aloud the article on treason from the French Penal Code, Dreyfus knew that this nightmare was real. Reaching to the table, Dupaty pushed aside a dossier and revealed a pistol. "I'm innocent," the captain called out. "Kill me if you wish." "It is not for us to do that work of justice," the officer responded. "It's for you." Still ignorant of the specific charges brought against him, Dreyfus lashed back with a torrent of uncontrollable protest. The dictation itself had only taken 10 minutes. But the interrogation that followed lasted 2 hours. The strangers in civilian clothes, Cochefort from criminal investigations, his secretary, and Gribelin from the intelligence bureau, joined Dupaty to grill Dreyfus about trips to the provinces for the general staff and about his work with a technical section of the artillery. The captain learned that a certain document implicated him as a spy and that the army was conducting a thorough investigation of his background. But that was all. Alfred demanded more details. "Show me proof of the infamy you say I've committed." But he was ignored. "If the action you accuse me of were confirmed," he admitted, "I would be a miserable wretch, a coward. It is my honor as an officer that is at stake," he added. "And no matter how painful my situation become, I will defend myself to the end. I want to live to prove my innocence." Realizing that it would be impossible to exact a confession or a suicide, well, at least for now, Dupaty wrapped up the interrogation. At noon, under strict secrecy, the captain was transferred to Cherche Midi prison. On arrival at Cherche Midi prison, Alfred was locked in a dark cell. His pocket watch was taken from him, and his sense of time was lost. He began to suffer what the prison commander described as a complete nervous breakdown. Through the afternoon of October 15th, and across the 3 days and nights that followed, Dreyfus, walled in alive, paced his cell like a wild beast, shouting out his innocence and calling for his wife and children. He beat his head against the cell and drew blood. He continuously cried out, "My only crime is to have been born a Jew." Ordered not to speak to the prisoner, guards in the corridor listened to his shouts. Forzinetti, the prison commander, tried to calm him down. Alfred wanted to see his family, and he wanted a pen and paper to write to the Minister of War. Officials from the general staff, worried about the efforts of an international Jewish conspiracy to secure the prisoner's release, had ordered the prison commander to deny those requests. By the afternoon of the captain's first day at prison, Forzinetti, convinced of his innocence, had become his first staunch ally. Dupaty, who thought it was unwise to put those who are not Frenchmen of France in sensitive military positions, became his most implacable enemy. Ignoring the law, which required authorities to inform prisoners of the charges brought against them, Dupaty refused Dreyfus's demands for information and again ordered him to take dictation, forcing Dreyfus to write seated, standing, lying down, quickly, slowly, with and without gloves, right-handed, left-handed, in French and in German. Frustrated by the prisoner's resolve, the commandant turned from dictation to interrogation. The treasonous document, which the prisoner had still not seen after 10 days of interrogation, contained information on artillery and troop maneuvers. Information, Dupatie suggested, which could only have been compiled by a stagiaire moving through the offices of the Etat-Major. While most officers of Alsace origins were considered patriots, Dupatie insisted that Dreyfus's trips to the Lost Province under the guise of family visits must have included clandestine meetings with German agents. Alfred tried to convince Dupatie of his family's patriotism. Trips across the Vosges, he told Dupatie, were not unusual. Countless French Alsatians had been making the journey with and without approval for the past 2 decades. The more the prisoner stressed his devotion to Alsace and to France, the more Dupatie thought he protested too much. "I swear on my children that I'm innocent," Dreyfus repeated. "I have absolutely no idea what you want of me. Perhaps if you showed me the incriminating document, I would understand. After 11 days, I still do not know what you accuse me of doing." With sleepless days following nights of interrogation and with no news from his family, Alfred edged towards suicide. Dupatie was a strange fella. Some people even suggested he was mad. He believed, for example, that any movement in the prisoner's legs signaled guilt, because the movement of the feet is linked to the movement of the heart. Whether he was mad or not is debatable. What is not under dispute is that he was relentless. The prisoner's mental state is indescribable, Forzinetti, the prison commander, reported to his superiors. Since his last interrogation, he has had frequent fainting spells and hallucinations, alternately sobbing and laughing. He says that he is losing his mind. Still protesting his innocence, he cries out that he will go mad before that innocence is recognized. He constantly demands to see his wife and children, and he fears that he will succumb to an act of desperation, despite all the precautions which have been taken, or that he will be overcome by madness. The only response to Forzinetti's appeal, however, was an increase in the number of guards assigned to the prisoner and a prescription of sedatives. Finally, on October 29th, Dupatie showed Dreyfus a photograph of the key document. "Do you recognize this letter as being in your handwriting?" the commandant asked. Although exhausted and sedated, Alfred was immediately relieved. The handwriting was clearly not his. The document was a bordereau, or memorandum, and the one-page document listed 5 topics to be covered in subsequent communication. Dreyfus explained to Dupatie why he could not possibly be its author. The document referred to hydraulic braking systems for a 120mm cannon, a topic Dreyfus had not studied since the École de Guerre and was not familiar with. It mentioned a project for a firing manual about which he knew nothing about. And as for a note pertaining to Madagascar, the captain had never been involved with any assignment concerning that location. And supposedly written only a few months before, the memorandum ended with the words, "I am off to maneuvers." But official records would confirm that Dreyfus had not been on maneuvers since the previous year. "I repeat that I did not write it, and I want to be heard by the minister," said Dreyfus. Dupatie ignored the request and closed the session. The next morning, he announced that the minister would see Dreyfus if, and only if, he wished to confess. He then informed the Conseil de Guerre that sufficient proof existed to open an official inquiry, and on November 5th, two new interrogators rushed to compile a dossier on Dreyfus's private and professional life based on interviews with colleagues and acquaintances. The new investigation uncovered nothing that pointed to espionage. Once more, Dreyfus challenges interrogators to provide proof of his treason, but these new interrogators were as deaf to the prisoner's attempt to respond logically to each accusation as Dupaty had been. Through it all, however, Dreyfus never questioned the motives of the military high command or doubted the honor of his superiors. After the second phase of interrogation came to an end, Alfred was asked if he had anything more to say. "I left my position in Alsace to serve my country with devotion. Today, as yesterday, I am worthy of leading my soldiers into battle." To his accusers, that final statement, like the protest on the day of his arrest, sounded hollow, melodramatic, and most importantly, unconvincing. Alfred Dreyfus's court-martial was to take place on December 19th, 1894. On December 5th, 1894, a few weeks before the court-martial, Alfred was finally allowed to send a letter to his wife. In it, he recalled the life that smiled upon them until the moment that he was accused, of, and I quote, "the most monstrous crime a soldier can commit." He described his isolation and his resolute, logical conscience that told him, "Hold your head high and look at the world face on. It is a terrible test, but one must suffer it." And in a theme that continued throughout his future letters, he asked how, quote, "France, whom I love with all my soul, all my heart, could accuse me of such an appalling crime." From the moment of his arrest, Dreyfus was fully committed to the promise of French justice, a promise that for him had not been broken. "I place my hope in God and in justice," he told Lucy in his first prison letter. And as his trial approached, he declared himself ready to appear before his judges as he would, quote, "one day appear before God, head high and conscience clear," end quote. He considered the attack on his integrity as an assault on the entire French officer corps. On December 8th, in anticipation of his courtroom appearance, he asked Lucy to send his best dress uniform, finest kepi, and wet gloves to Cherche Midi. He would manifest his allegiance in every way. "They will see on my face, they will read in my soul, my innocence." He remained confident that, and I quote, "loyal and honest soldiers will one day recognize, I am sure of it, the error which has been committed." Lucy, fearing that his exaggerated commitment to military honor might push him to the noble solution of suicide, reminded him of his duty as a father and inserted a message from their three-year-old son. "My papa, you must return on the train quickly before it gets cold. so that I could give you a good kiss. Dreyfus read the note and cried, but he also promised Lucie that he would not take his life. He also implored her to devote all her efforts and intelligence, and if necessary, their entire fortune, to finding the real traitor. Money is nothing, honor is all. We have always been more than brothers, he wrote Mathieu on December 12th. We shared thoughts and hopes in common. What sustains me, what allows me to keep my head high, is my clear conscience. My life entirely devoted to honor. I defy anyone to take it from me. Through November and early December, the population of Mulhouse greeted the reports of the captain's arrest no differently than did the population of Paris. The overwhelming majority believed what they read, or read what they wanted to believe, and assumed that the government had proof of Dreyfus's intrigues with a foreign power. Close friends and fellow industrialists who knew the family, however, rallied in support. Most confirmed their readiness to help the family. Old friends of Alfred's father, Raphael, would offer to contribute money towards finding the real criminal, and other members of the Alsace elite pursued leads in European diplomatic circles and in the French high command. Colonel Jean-Conrad Sandel was the one that directed the office responsible for uncovering the Bordereau and calling for Dreyfus's arrest. As the commander of French counter-espionage, he and his team were eager to protect national security. In 1870, Sandel's father, a Protestant that converted to Catholicism, had marched down through Mulhouse, shouting, "Down with the Prussians of the interior," which in local parlance meant, "Down with Protestants and Jews." Later, at a military ceremony in the Vosges, Colonel Sandel confirmed that he was his father's son. Seeing an Alsatian Jew moved to tears by the commemoration, he told a colleague that he distrusted those tears. Why? Because I distrust the Jews. When another officer from Mulhouse suggested to Sandel that it was impossible for an Alsatian like Dreyfus, product of our great military schools and son of a rich and respected family, to have turned against his country, Sandel replied, "You're right. It would be incomprehensible for others, but he is a Jew." If the likes of Sandel and Dupaty were to be witnesses for the prosecution, Mathieu had to find character witnesses for his brother. But unfortunately, he met with very little success. Mathieu needed military men, officers, from instructors, administrators at the École de Guerre to the captain's former colleagues and superiors in Paris and provincial garrisons. But Mathieu received either polite rejections or hostile tirades. He found only one officer, Commandant Clément, who promised to testify. Later, eventually, after much prodding by the family, four other officers agreed to submit the positions, describing the captain as a good and loyal soldier. It was a very courageous group of witnesses, but also a very weak alliance with which to confront the Ministry of War and the entire high command. A few days before the court-martial, Demange had asked Mathieu to go to the clerk's office at the Conseil de Guerre to pay for the copying of legal briefs. Mathieu learned that the clerk had access to the bordereau, and when he asked to see it, the clerk agreed. most likely for a fee. Locking all the doors, he quickly fetched the Dreyfus dossier and showed the man the small single sheet of lightweight paper. Stupefied by the document, Mathieu noted only a vague resemblance to Alfred's handwriting and striking differences which leapt to the eye. He reacted precisely as his brother had done when Dupaty first brought the bordereau to Cherchemidi prison. The army's case could not possibly stand on such thin evidence. Mathieu wondered why the general staff was pursuing a major case of treason with such limited evidence. Disquieted by rumors that the army would demand a trial in closed session, Mathieu was now certain that his brother had been the victim of a conspiracy. Demange informed Mathieu that military officials were now considering the document a masterful example of self-forgery, a highly technical achievement on the part of Dreyfus, designed to disguise his own hand. Ridiculous. The court-martial was scheduled for noon. By late morning, the combination of winter weather and reports that the trial would be closed to the public had limited the crowd to barely 30 curious onlookers. Inside the cramped, high-ceilinged courtroom, journalists, clerks, and witnesses awaited the arrival of the 7 military judges. Heavy drapes covered the 4 bay windows, kept the room relatively dark. At first, Mathieu and Jacques, the only 2 members of the family to attend the proceedings, were denied permission to enter. They appealed to the commandant in charge and after much difficulty were allowed to stand in the back of the room. They had not seen their brother Alfred in over 4 months. Clad in the crisp brass-buttoned uniform with gold braid that Lucy had sent to him, the captain entered the hall with his head high. Flanked by a lieutenant of the Republican Guard, he moved with a firm military step to his place facing a crucifix which hung above the judges on the courtroom's far wall. The prisoner's thin frame, dull complexion, and prominent cheekbones, and streaks of gray in his hair were the evidence of over 8 weeks in a small, damp prison cell. Saluting the tribunal, he responded to the colonel's opening questions in a clear, calm voice. Your age? 35. Your place of birth? Mulhouse, Alsace. Over previous days, Alfred's lawyer, Demange, had attempted to convince government officials that a public trial would be in the best interests of both the army and the accused. He knew fairly well that Dreyfus had everything to fear from a closed session. Demange sent his appeal to the Minister of War, General Mercier, but met with no success. For months, the nationalist and anti-Semitic press had been attacking Mercier for the breakdown of military order and for his inability to rid the general staff of treasonous Jews, Protestants, and Freemasons. Dreyfus's arrest only confirmed their belief in Mercier's human idiocy and in turn intensified the minister's desire to limit the damage. As the trial began, courtroom observers anticipated a call for a closed session. When Demange referred to a single piece of incriminating evidence against Dreyfus, the judges immediately stopped the proceedings, ignored the lawyer's protests, and adjourned to consider that the court martial be closed to the public for reasons of national security. After 15 minutes of deliberation, the judges returned with a unanimous verdict and ordered to clear the room. Captain Dreyfus remained quiet, exhibiting a confidence which worried the prosecution. His attitude, according to someone present, was soldierly, strong, and absolutely correct. Through the afternoons and evenings of the testimony, he listened and learned. Officers recounted the history of the bordereau, its discovery by an agent in a foreign embassy in Paris, and the realization that the memorandum must have been written by a member of the general staff who had access to its many offices. In other words, by a stagiaire moving through the various sections of the état-major. Two officers involved in the first stages of the investigation, Lieutenant Colonel Henri d'Aboville and Colonel Pierre Fabre, told how they settled on Dreyfus as a prime suspect, and after comparing his handwriting, how they reported their findings to superiors. In 16 years of military life, since he first arrived at the gates of the École Polytechnique, Dreyfus had received only two negative assessments of his performance. One from the anti-Semite Bonfond at the École de Guerre, and the other from that same Colonel Fabre at the État-Major. An incomplete officer, went Fabre's description in 1893. Very intelligent and devoted, but pretentious and not able, from the point of view of character, conscience, and manner of service, to fulfill the conditions necessary for employment on the general staff of the army. Despite its impressive array of witnesses, the prosecution's case was not going very well. The first staff officer to see the bordereau, Henri, had worked for months with his friend Dupaty to prepare the dossier against Dreyfus. Son of a peasant and veteran of the 1870 war, the broad-shouldered and brutish Henri was an avid admirer of Edouard Drumont, and a firm believer in the perils of Jewish infiltration. He was determined to save the prosecution's case. After having testified in the early stages of the trial, he secretly sent word to one of the judges. He told him that he wished to be recalled and asked a specific question regarding the presence of a traitor in the deuxième bureau, the intelligence section of the état-major. Taking the stand, he announced in a loud voice and with a sweeping gesture that an absolutely honorable person had alerted him the previous spring to a traitor within the ranks. That same informant had later provided more details and identified the officer. "There he is," Henry shouted, as he pointed to Dreyfus. "That man is a traitor." The prisoner and his lawyer immediately stood up to protest the introduction of hearsay evidence, objecting to the illegality of Henry's remarks, and they demanded to know the name of the informant. But Henry, confident that the judges would respect the army's need for secrecy, pointed to his own military cap and announced that there are secrets in an officer's head that even his kepi should not know. Dreyfus and Demange pushed their protests, but the judges never intervened. "We will not ask you the name," they assured Henri, "but do you affirm on your honor that this traitor was attached to the deuxième bureau and that it is Captain Dreyfus?" Turning to the crucifix, Henri said, "I swear it." Henri's testimony defined the trial. It was the inner circle of the état-major. Many of its members, disciples of the anti-Semite Drumont, pitted against a Jewish stagiaire. The prosecution was, of course, left with one key missing piece, the question of motive. But for Henri Dupaty and the officers steeped in Drumont's theories of eternal Jewish treason, the motive was quite obvious. Mathieu and Lucy met the lawyer every evening, and with other family members and friends began to share concern about the trial's outcome. Only Alfred remained confident. He was certain, after 9 weeks of isolation, that the family would be reunited the next day. On Saturday, December 22nd, Mathieu and Demange shared a carriage to the courtroom. Before entering, the lawyer summarized the captain's chances. If an order has not been given to condemn him, he will be acquitted this evening. During the judge's deliberation, Captain Dreyfus was waiting in the prison infirmary adjoining the courtroom. In accordance with military law, he would not be present when his verdict was read in public session. After an hour, the door opened, Demange entered, and without a word, took the prisoner in his arms. They moved to a dark hall off the courtroom, where Judge Advocate Brisset, surrounded by military guards, read the verdict by candlelight. At attention, his arms straight against his body and showing no emotion, Dreyfus listened. Today, 22nd of December, 1894, the first court-martial has unanimously declared Captain Alfred Dreyfus of the 14th Artillery Regiment, probationer of the General Staff, guilty of having delivered to a foreign power or to its agents a certain number of secret or confidential documents concerning national defense, in order to obtain for that power the means to commit hostilities or to undertake war against France. Accordingly, the court unanimously condemns the above-mentioned Dreyfus to the punishment of deportation in a fortified place and to military degradation. To add insult to injury, but conforming to the code of military justice, Alfred would also pay the expenses of his court-martial. "I implored him to live until tomorrow," the lawyer told Mathieu, "and I refused to leave until he gave me his word that he would not take his life." "My brother must sign his petition for appeal," Mathieu said before leaving. "Make him sign it tomorrow." Surrounded by soldiers, Dreyfus maintained his self-control. But when the prison guards led him back to the infirmary, the stoic discipline he had displayed for 4 days gave way to panic. He hurled himself against the wall, as he had done on the night of his arrest, and beat his head and limbs like a madman. One guard seized him by the waist and tried to calm him, but without success. Having come to his trial meticulously clad in his finest dress uniform, he was taken back across the deserted street at midnight with his officer's cloak wrapped around his arms like a straitjacket, the hood pulled over his head. "My only crime is to have been born a Jew," he continuously cried out to Forzinetti, as he had done so 2 months before in that damp prison cell. He demanded a revolver, but Forzinetti understood by now Dreyfus's character and the language needed to control him, and stayed through the night to talk soldier to soldier about honor, justice, and the shame of accepting defeat. Still prohibited from visiting the prison, Lucy wrote the morning after the conviction. You must live for the children and for me. Later the same day, she promised, everywhere you go or where they send you, I will follow. We will raise our children together. On the day after his trial, and for the first time since his arrest, he asked to see Rabbi Zadok Khan, a fellow Alsatian, France's grand rabbi, and the man who officiated his wedding 4 years before. Khan had been trying to help Dreyfus's cause for weeks, and when he received the prisoner's appeal, he quickly wrote to the military governor of Paris, asking authorization to bring Dreyfus religious support. Their request was denied. In complete isolation across the days and nights following his court-martial, Dreyfus was kept alive by Forzinetti's surveillance, Demange's support, and a flood of family letters. Dreyfus signed the appeal for review, but with little hope for success. Nevertheless, he promised in a letter to defeat the enemy, or at least die in the breach. He knew it would take months, most likely years, for Demange and the family to uncover the truth and secure his release. As the government ignored them and now many friends turned away, new enemies inspired by the nationalist and anti-Semitic press forced family members into their homes for protection. In a wave of euphoric self-congratulation, La Libre Parole and scores of other newspapers, left, right, and center, applauded the army's victory. The sacred military had been purged of a traitorous Jew. And there was the satisfaction of knowing that Dreyfus would be publicly humiliated and sent to suffer in perpetual exile. The attacks, however, were now moving beyond concerns about a single officer. Jews out of France, Drumont wrote on the day of Dreyfus's conviction. France for the French. There's quite a lot more, but I think I'll leave the rest of that filth out of the podcast with your permission. Dreyfus compiled a detailed list for his wife. Knowing that he would soon be prohibited from wearing his uniform, he asked her to pack his best civilian clothes, asked her to purchase a sturdy portable inkwell, and an English grammar book with exercises suited for a classroom of one. Encouraged by her husband's plans for the future, Lucy wrote back that she and Mathieu would also study English. The best method, you know, is to read a lot and to familiarize yourself with the vocabulary. Buy the children toys for New Year's Day, Alfred wrote on December 26th. And tell them they're from their father. The poor things are just beginning life and they must not suffer our troubles. It had been 10 weeks since Dreyfus had left the apartment for that inspection at the General Staff headquarters. His wife was still waiting for permission to visit him inside the prison. On New Year's Eve, Dupaty returned to the prison to inform the prisoner that his appeal had been denied. Anticipating a violent reaction, he posted a guard outside the cell, but Dreyfus remained calm. On this visit, however, Dupaty came with an offer. If Dreyfus exposed his network of treason, or if he admitted that he had written the bordereau as a ploy to obtain more sensitive documents from the German and Italian attachés in Paris, the government could recognize extenuating circumstances and perhaps lighten the prisoner's sentence. It could, Dupaty intimated, cancel the public degradation, or arrange for Dreyfus's wife and children to accompany him into a relatively comfortable exile. Dreyfus's patience broke. "Enough," he told Dupaty. "I am innocent, and your duty is to pursue your investigation." "If you are innocent," Dupaty responded, "you are the greatest martyr of all time." Late that night, Alfred recounted the Dupaty interview in a letter to his lawyer, Demange. He also wrote to the Minister of War, "I have received by your order a visit from Monsieur le Commandant Dupaty de Clam, to whom I have declared that I am innocent and that I have never committed the slightest indiscretion of any sort. I am condemned. I have no favor to demand. But in the name of my honor, which I hope will be returned to me one day, it is my duty to ask you to pursue your investigation. After I'm gone, continue the search. It is the only favor I ask." A few days later, on the morning of January 2nd, 1895, Forzinetti told Dreyfus that his wife would visit him that afternoon. When a guard arrived to lead him downstairs, Alfred nearly collapsed. He entered the dark prison basement where he could barely see his wife through the thick wire of two partitions that separated them. Surrounded by guards and struggling to see more than their silhouettes through the iron grates, he spoke only for a short time before Alfred reached the end of his strength. "Don't think that my spirit has diminished," he assured Lucy. "It is only my body, which is a bit weak after 3 months of confinement. I want my honor, and I shall have it. No obstacle will stop me." Forzinetti, angered by the army's inhumane treatment of Dreyfus, appealed to the minister that the couple be allowed to meet in the prison commandant's office in his presence. Relatives of many convicted men had obtained the privilege of using the special visitor's room, Forzinetti wrote, and it could be granted to Madame Dreyfus. The army relented, and on the evening of January 3rd, Dreyfus and his wife held each other for the very first time in nearly 12 weeks. Originally scheduled for the morning of Friday, January 4th, Alfred's degradation was postponed by a day. Military authorities offered no explanation, but some observers thought it fitting that the traitor be publicly condemned on the Jewish Sabbath. On the eve of his degradation, he wrote Demange, "To tell you that my heart will not be tortured when they strip the badges of honor for which I have worked so hard would be to lie. I would 1,000 times prefer death. But you have informed me of my duty, and you have given me faith." He promised the lawyer that he would march to his punishment head high. And Captain Alfred Dreyfus very much did. Head high, and with exaggerated military discipline, Dreyfus faced his degradation as he had faced his court-martial. And he did so from the very first moment guards entered his cell at 7:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 5th. After loosening his epaulettes, brass buttons, and gold officer's braid so they would tear away more easily, and after scoring his sword so it would break swiftly and cleanly, the guards brought him to the prison gates where he was searched and handcuffed. Forzinetti, the prison commander, more than ever convinced of Dreyfus's innocence, protested the treatment, but to no avail. Shaking the prisoner's hand, he turned him over to the Republican Guard. Mounted troops surrounded a black prison wagon drawn by four horses, and they galloped southwest down the Rue de Cherche Midi toward the École Militaire. Crowds had already started to gather in the piercing cold outside, and military authorities directed journalists, diplomats, and dignitaries to reserved sections inside the courtyard. The contingent of international journalists included Theodor Herzl, a Hungarian Jew on assignment for an Austrian newspaper. If you're unfamiliar with this name, stay tuned for a future episode, or maybe episodes. Shortly before 8 a.m., Dreyfus's wagon sped past the crowd and toward a garrison office, where under the watch of Captain Charles Lebrun Renault of the Republican Guard, the prison waited until the bells of the École Militaire struck 9. Bells sounded, military drums rolled, and four artillery soldiers, sabers in hand, led Dreyfus into the Cour Morland. Every regiment of the Paris garrison had been ordered to send two detachments to this ceremony, one of soldiers in arms, the other of young recruits. Moving diagonally across the courtyard's vast expanse and toward a general on horseback at its center, Dreyfus marched under the chiseled inscription, École Supérieure de Guerre. It was the place where he had spent the most important years of his military career. In lockstep with his guards, he stumbled briefly, then regained his balance. The guards retreated, leaving the prisoner alone in front of General Darras and Valical, the clerk of the court martial. In a loud, clear voice, Valical read out the act of judgment, saluted Darras, and stepped back. Dreyfus' heels together and at attention remained silent. Standing in his stirrups, the general raised his sword, looked down at the prisoner, and announced, "Alfred Dreyfus, you're not worthy of bearing arms. In the name of the French people, we degrade you." In fulfillment of the promise he had made it to himself and to his family, the prisoner broke his silence, raised both hands, forced his head even higher, and shouted, "Soldiers, they are degrading an innocent man. Soldiers, they are dishonoring an innocent man. Long live France, long live the army." Another silence followed, broken seconds later by the crowd chanting, "Death, death." Sergeant Major quickly approached Dreyfus and slashed the gold braids from his cap and uniform. He stripped the regiment numbers from his collar, ripped off his brass buttons, and kneeling down while the prisoner remained at strict attention, tore from Dreyfus's pants legs the red stripes he had worn since his entrance into the École Polytechnique. Finally, he took the sword, broke it over his knee, pulled off the captain's scabbard and leather belt, and threw the pieces to the ground. With his kepi now misshapen and threads hanging from his uniform, Dreyfus repeated his protest, "I am innocent." Stepping over the pile at his feet, he moved off the narrow cobblestone pathway that ran down the center of the Cour Morland and began the degradation parade around the courtyard's periphery. He knew the regulations. and he seemed to lead his guards like an officer commanding his troops. When Dreyfus passed a special section reserved for officers' wives, the women began their own chants, and one near the parade line spit in the prisoner's face. He called out, "I swear on my wife and children that I'm innocent. Vive la France!" The prisoner's protests were met with a torrent of hisses and shouts of "Traitor, traitor, death to the Jew." Nearing the end of his march, Dreyfus stopped again in front of the press. "Tomorrow you will tell all of France that I'm innocent," he said. The journalists, like the army wives, lashed back. "Shut up, you wretch, coward, Judas, filthy Jew." The entire spectacle had taken only 10 minutes. Alfred Dreyfus was moved on by the Republican Guard, handcuffed, and pushed into the waiting prison wagon. Along the route, crowds gathered and shouted, "Traitor! Death to the Jew." Minutes later, at the Central Prison Depot, Dreyfus was dragged from room to room, photographed, searched, measured, and stripped of his uniform. Now in the hands of civilian officials, he came under the authority of the Ministry of the Interior. The process took 3 hours, and when the director of the depot told his prisoner how sad he was to inscribe the words "crime of treason" next to the name of a French officer, Dreyfus responded, "I understand your indignation, but I'm innocent." I think this is as good a place as any to stop. I'll probably need 3 more episodes to do justice to this story. Again, most of the research is from the great book by Michael Burns, Dreyfus, A Family Affair. I will leave a link in the show notes, or simply visit theisraelpodcast.com/episode006. Thanks for listening and checking out The Israel Podcast. I hope you tune in next time for another episode.